Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. News of the discovery of gravitational waves dominated the science world a couple weeks ago. UWM scientists were among those who played a large role in that discovery.
Our astronomy contributor, Gene Creighton, tells Lake Effect's Bonnie North that beyond its scientific importance, this discovery also had some personal significance.
I should give a full disclosure here that although I don't work in gravitational waves, my spouse does. Julian Creighton does. And in fact, many of my friends around the world are part of this collaboration. So for me, there is a very definite personal aspect to this, even though, you know, this is not my work. So I'm in that perfect place, that sweet spot of involvement without getting too caught up in, you know, the nitty-gritty of your work stuff. So 20 years ago, almost to the day, my husband came home and said, well, I have a choice in front of me. I could either continue doing very theoretical thermodynamics of black holes, or I could get involved in this project called LIGO. They're looking for gravitational waves. He explained a little bit the project, and I said, that smells like a Nobel Prize to me. There is a risk. Of course, there's a gamble, because when you change fields, there's a learning curve, and there's a certain amount of time that's not as productive as if you were to stay in what you were doing already. But I felt that it was probably going to be worthwhile to get into this new field, and interesting, and I thought it would suit him, and so he did. So it was a personal triumph to know that, you know, this project, which was a gamble, came to fruition. And it's effectively the doors that open. You get to start a whole new career at this point. I wanted to acknowledge and admire the big gamble. I mean, I described a fairly small gamble in the scheme of things, but I wanted to celebrate the big gamble that NSF took, the National Science Foundation. They decided to fund a project that, yes, it had the possibility of a tremendous, return, tremendous reward, but of course, it could have been all for naught. And it's just so marvelous as a scientist to see that society supported what would be considered very basic science. And I don't mean by basic easy, but fundamental science. Addressing the nature of gravity is not going to change your tax return very soon, but it kind of makes us solve problems that I'm sure maybe even in the near term are going to affect people's lives in direct ways.
And it's a gamble that took place over 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
This didn't happen in two.
No. And I was, again, thrilled and proud that they stayed in it for the long run. They stayed the course. You know, they didn't say, yeah, a little bit and I'll take away. And they didn't waver. They kind of stuck to the purpose. And you have to give, you know, credit where credit is due. So yay for NSF.
Yeah. And we don't tend to think of scientific exploration as something that requires gambling. But we do have to gamble that you're going to get knowledge. You're going to get something at the
right
end of this very long slog, in this case,
right,
that means something really amazing.
Right, right. And I think the point is that really hard problems are by definition not something you can say, oh, I'll just send a couple people here and they're going to solve this problem. This was a theoretical and a technological major, major achievement. It would necessarily require a large group of people, a commitment, time for this to come together. So
there was celebration in the Creighton household.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the other interesting aspect here are predictions. So, of course, the big prediction we're celebrating is that Einstein came up with this idea about space-time, about how gravity isn't a force like Newton suggested that kind of works magically from a distance, but that it's a different kind of geometry. It's a curvature of space and time. An elegant way of putting it, these of course are not my words, but an elegant way of thinking about it is that matter tells space and time how to curve, and space tells matter how to move. So these are nice words, but the math is hard as nails. I mean, these are tricky equations. And from the equations of general relativity, basically people were able to make several predictions, one of which was gravitational waves. And it was of the four main predictions that Einstein made with his general theory of relativity, it was the one that was still outstanding, direct detection of gravitational waves. What's, I think, elegant about this is this idea in science that if your theory is any good, if your idea is interesting and worthwhile, it makes predictions that can be tested. Maybe not right away, but in time. It's particularly elegant if you can make a prediction that at the time seemed impossible. This would never be either turned down or proven because we simply do not have the wherewithal to do it. Einstein thought it would be impossible to ever measure gravitational waves. So you could say that he could put together such an idea knowing full well that nobody will ever be able to take it down. And yet now we built an instrument that was capable of measuring such a small distance. The example that's often used is if a gravitational wave went through, say, the sun and the nearest star outside the sun, so that's Alpha Proxima Centauri, the difference in length of that particular distance would be just the width of your hair. And the machine could measure such a change.
You know, I would love to think that Einstein was somewhere going, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Who would have thought?
Who would have thought?
Yeah. Yeah. So this was measured. And even more so, people worked hard with these equations to anticipate what this squiggle, let me just call it squiggle, because I realize if you don't look at these things, the signature of the gravitational wave just looked like a curvy line. The details of which are dependent on the physical properties of the bodies involved, in this case, two black holes. So the fact that we were able to get supercomputers to analyze how two black holes moving around each other would disturb space and what that would look like when two laser beams interfered together, and that it looked, the signal looked so incredibly the same, almost as if, you know, you have a little textbook chirp, we call them. It looked exactly like that. It looked exactly like what you predicted. And one of the, like, here we got lucky. Here it was definitely a matter of luck. The object was so powerful. The two black holes were so, so big and, relatively speaking, close to us, that we could see it without fancy analysis of software. You could just see it with a naked eye if you were a little trained. Mm-hmm. I could see it just boom. And I didn't realize it was so, so strong until I saw the signal. I thought, oh my goodness, you can just eyeball this. Many others, I'm sure, in the future will have little gravitational waves that are buried in the noise. And that's going to become, I think, more the norm. But for the very first one, we got lucky and we saw something that was particularly strong.
And it's just giving me goosebumps thinking about seeing that. Where you, like you said, you could just look at it and go, oh, there it is.
And what is that? Well, we saw two black holes that are about 30 solar masses moving at about half the speed of light. So let's say the distance between them was about this is real numbers, about the width of Wisconsin. And they merged together in about a quarter of a second. And in that quarter of a second, the power from that event outshone every other star and every other galaxy combined. This was like taking three masses of the sun and changing it into energy. And you know, of course, that E equals mc squared. So you multiply the mass of the sun, which is pretty significant, by the speed of light times the speed of light. And that's the kind of energy that you get from this event.
Holy cow.
I know. I mean, there's so many superlatives involved in this observation. But I mean, setting aside how impossibly powerful and fast and magnificent and strong this was, it does, again, open that door that I mentioned before. We will be able to eventually, probably by 2020 anyway. That's when we expect the sensitivity of the instruments to get to the design. They're not even there yet. They're at the 30% level. They have a long way to go before they're, you know, as good as they could be. We could get to the point where we're sitting in our chair and saying, oh yeah, another one, another black hole binary. Yep. Mm-hmm. Second one for today. Yep. It'll become pretty
mundane,
pretty ordinary. Yeah. And we'll get to the point where we build statistics and we have hundreds of them. And I mean, that will help us understand what percentage of stars become black holes. What does it take to make such a black hole? Because quite frankly, 30 solar masses, for many people, that was considered black holes don't even get to be that big. So now we have to get back to the drawing board and find out what ideas we had to make such big black holes anyway. Which leads us to what we call the IMF. So that's the initial mass function. If you have a cloud and they make stars, what percentage of those stars is going to be this mass range? Which is going to be there? It tells us so much about stars overall. So it helps us narrow down some of our ideas and kind of rule out. You can't prove something to be true, but you certainly can disprove it. So if you have data that rules out a theory because of what it predicted, then that goes away. And you strengthen the ideas that we have that are supported by the data that we have.
It was a big deal.
It was a big deal.
In so many ways.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So not only do we, in the end, we'll understand a whole lot more about stars, but the technological aspects of this. So to give you some idea, LIGO produces about 1 terabyte of data a day.
It's a lot.
That is so much that people have to worry, where are we going to store this? What happens if I analyze this with supercomputers, which you have to, you know, if I have 5,000 computers in a system, well, there'll be some failing every day. So how do I make it so that no information is lost? It will help us solve problems that we had to solve for LIGO that will come up. Big data is something that we're all considering, we're all thinking about. I bet that in 20 years, we'll say, wow, look at all those things that came up from LIGO we hadn't even considered.
Well, Jean, thank you so much, as always, both for the personal story in this case, but also sort of the overview of why these gravitational waves, why this discovery is so important.
Thank you. It was a pleasure, as always.
Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium on the UW-Milwaukee campus and our regular astronomy contributor.